Your next speaker is Avon Malone.
Which I think was very much the way it was done, you know, in the first century. They that were scattered abroad went everywhere preaching the word. They were already being scattered. The persecution around the martyrdom of Stephen pushed them out from Jerusalem, and they were scattered. And as they were scattered, they went preaching. And it was really a natural thing. I'll tell you something. To go up to a door, just cold turkey, you don't know anybody there, that's terrifying to me. I've done it. It's not one of the most effective ways to evangelize. Now, you talk about batting average. I don't know who hit the lowest for the Cardinals. That'd be a dubious distinction, wouldn't it, Brother Jim? But whoever it was had a high batting average compared to the kind of batting average you have with that kind of approach. I don't really think that's the way they did it. The slave girl, as she combed the tresses of her haughty mistress, dared to whisper into her ear the story of spiritual freedom. The desk of the tax collector, the counter of the merchant, the plow handles of the farmer, why, these were their pulpits, and it was a natural thing. They had contact with people, not total strangers, but people they know and people they loved, and they showed that love. I really think that was one of the great things that Terry Rush emphasized. Communicate the love. And I was impressed by the fact that he wrote to people, the families of well-known folk and celebrities and others, but people who also hungered for the expression of love. And he expressed that love. And that's really what we need to be doing. And you know, that just dissipates and destroys a lot of the fear and a lot of the apprehension that we've had. I've tried that door-to-door business, and I know about me smiting one against the other. And the immense relief that you have when nobody answers the door, you know, that sort of thing. Well, there's places for that. If you're going to have a VBS or you're taking a religious census, or there are other places where that can be used effectively. But that never produces the best contact. The best contact is that fellow you see every day on the job, that lady you talk to over the backyard fence, that loved one or that neighbor or that person that you could make a contact with if you'd express love. And so we're grateful for the good things that have come out of this recent series. There were a lot of them. And I think we're indebted to Bob Forrester, because Bob just had a lot to do with that. And I want to express appreciation to Bob. The whole thing, to a great extent, was a part of his work and his dream. And he had a lot to do with bringing it to fruition. And I want to express appreciation there. I hope that the many good things, the great emphases in that series, we will seize and we'll love one another more, and we'll be expressive of it, and we'll love people in this lost world, and we'll express that love. The people that we reach are going to be people that we've drawn into the circle of friendship. Now, I'm sure that we don't lead people to Jesus just by trying to out-friendly other religious folk, because there are a lot of them that can do that well. But on the other hand, genuine love, sincerely expressed, will open doors. And with a lot of people, as you well know, it's love, not logic, that opens locks. So we express that, we make the contact, and then pray for the providential opening of doors, and I'm sure that'll follow. There's a milestone that we passed kind of unnoticed, but I'm going to mention it. Actually, I guess the time to notice it, I was in Falls Valley in a meeting. But I preached for this good church for the first time in the capacity of working here regularly on last November the 9th. And it's very hard for me to realize that. On five Sundays prior to that, back in June, July, and so on five Sundays, five different Sundays prior to that, it had been my privilege to speak here on a Lord's Day. But it was on November the 9th that I spoke, having begun to work with this good church in a regular way, and I felt then and feel now highly privileged. And I want you to know that. I'm very, very grateful for that opportunity, and I can hardly believe, this is November 15th, I can hardly believe that a year elapsed. And incidentally, I'm going to do better on my scheduling. I'm going to try to work that out better. But I wish I could work it out some way, how I could do better on my scheduling and still just get to hear Larry Journey every now and then. I don't know how to do that, but I know you're enjoying that. At any rate, I've appreciated your patience with some scheduling problems that I've had. And I have an appreciation for this good church that I cannot adequately express. Let's turn to John chapter 6. And let me explain that a series we've been in on Lord's Day evening, we're going to resume next Sunday evening, Lord willing. And incidentally, that'll give us a good opportunity to practice some of the things that we've been talking about and hearing about recently. Because we've been in a series of meeting lessons, evangelistic type lessons, and I want to come back to that again next Lord's Day evening. That's a good opportunity then to invite that friend to say, hey, come go with me. And we'll eat before, or we'll eat after services, and come and go with me. That's not hard to do. That's not hard to do. So let's do that and get maximum mileage. But I'm going to veer from that series a little bit tonight and actually continue something that we've been doing for the most part on Sunday morning. You may remember that on many of the recent Sunday mornings, we've looked at some of the great I Am statements in the Gospel of John. I want to look at one tonight that really falls into that category, but it's often overlooked. And the I Am is almost obscured in some of our English translations. But there's a text in the 6th chapter of John that I think will help me in the fight that I have with fear. It may help you in the fight that you have with fear. I'd like for us to read at verse 15 down through verse 21. And later we'll talk about this and kind of put it in its context here. But as a beginning point tonight, let's read this together. Jesus, therefore, perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him a king, withdrew again into the mountains himself alone. And when evening came, his disciples went down unto the sea. And they entered into a boat, and they were going over the sea unto Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea was rising by reason of a great wind that blew. When therefore they'd rowed 25 or 30 furlongs, they behold Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh unto the boat, and they were afraid. But he said unto them, It is I, and that could well be rendered, I am. It is I, or I am, be not afraid. They were willing, therefore, to receive him into the boat, and straightway the boat was at the land whither they were going. We're going to come back to this in a few moments, and we'll see it in its context. He's just fed the 5,000. There are great numbers out there in the wilderness at this particular time, up in Galilee, and yet it's the time of one of the great annual feasts. I wonder why they'd all be out there. So many, thousands at a time like that. And the first verse we read said they tried to take him by force and make him a king. So keep that context in mind and keep this passage before you. We'll come back to it in a few moments. Lloyd John Ogilvie, a noted speaker, well-known writer, counselor, tells about counseling a lady who seemed to have it all together. She was very well dressed. She was, on the surface, apparently very well poised, composed, a lady who seemed to function well. And the folks who knew her on the job and in her neighborhood and elsewhere would have scarcely guessed the panic that gripped her heart, that filled her mind in her waking moments and the frightening dreams that filled her thinking and her subconscious even when asleep. But she confided all of that to Lloyd John Ogilvie. And then he began to make certain recommendations to her. And she began to make some real progress. And he suggested what I would want to suggest on the basis of John 6 and countless other passages. That the real victory comes when we know Him. When we know the one who said, I am the way. When we know the one who said, I'm the good shepherd. When we know the one who said, I am the true vine. Then we began to overcome. And he made that recommendation. And on one occasion, the woman left one of the sessions radiant, believing that here's the answer. But she came back confiding something very, very interesting. I think very characteristic of us. I think really a very perceptive observation about herself and probably about many of us. She said, I found that I had become comfortable with my fears. I found that they were so familiar to me, so very familiar to me, that I had become comfortable with them, and actually and surprisingly uncomfortable without them. You know, old Linus in Charlie Brown's always got that blanket. Boy, he's always gripping that thing. He's never going to be very far away from it. And that's the way we do with some of our fears. And she said, I found that their very familiarity did not breed contempt, but actually contributed to a strange kind of comfort that I felt. How long must that go on? The counselor said, as long as you choose to allow it, you can change that. There is a volitional muscle in our makeup. And we can make some decisions and we can make some choices. And we can exercise that volitional muscle in obedience. And in doing that, we can overcome even those very familiar fears that have become a part of us. Fears with which when we grapple with them, we find that their very familiarity has built within us a certain sense of comfort. We can overcome that. Maybe you heard about the fellow who said, I'm so tense that when I'm calm, I get nervous. Well, apparently this lady was a little bit like that. And Mr. Ogilvie was assuring you there's a victory that can be gained in that matter. Let's think about some of the fears we have. Have you ever jogged at night? I haven't done very much of that up in Edmond, but I used to in Searcy sometimes. And boy, all the dogs would just let out, you know. And I thought, what if they got out? What if not just barking, they got out? Boy, what would happen? I know I told you about the time when we were trying to talk about walking in the light and how that is a continued course of action. And we just keep walking the light, 1 John 1:7. And I told you a true story back many years ago. I closed a meeting in Paradise, Texas. Now, some brethren have argued about whether or not there's a paradise, but I know there's a Paradise, Texas, up north of Fort Worth. And I was due to get on up to Kansas, and I had several reasons to want to get up there in a hurry. I was staying with a rural mail carrier, Brother Omer Cleveland. And I came home after the last service, went to sleep, and I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, if you're naturally bright or you've got something else wrong with you, you get these ideas. I said, boy, this is the time to travel. This is the time to go to Kansas. And I got in that old Chevrolet, and I headed for Kansas. We checked it on the speedometer, 6 3/10 miles later we checked it. And the timing gear stripped. And on Chevys of that vintage, the windshield wipers would go, and you stop dead still, and you don't go anywhere, you get professional help. So I started walking, and the dogs along here woke up the dogs down there, so they'd be ready when I got on down there. And boy, I tell you what, I was having problems that were both real and imagined, as you might imagine. Well, what if those fearful dogs that lurk in our minds suddenly got loose? Here's this fear of the future. This fear of the unknown, this fear of the untried and the untested and the unexplored, and yet we go into that day after day. Financial fears. There's another dog that barks in the night and seems so very frightening. Financial fears. One lady said, both my husband and I came from a very poor background, but it affected us differently. Said, old Moneybags keeps telling me that he's saving up for a rainy season. And she said it'd take a monsoon to loosen up old money bags. So I came out of a certain kind of background, and I want to spend, and he came out of one like that, and he wants to clench it tightly. And we have fears in that area. Fears with regard to friendships and relationships. We fear rejection. We fear that somehow or another we may be kind of isolated from the group or from this particular person or these people. And on and on and on we might go. Where's the real answer to this? We fear with regard to our health. We fear some of those great universal fears, the fear of death. There's a great answer to that in Hebrews 2. Time permits, we may look at some of the things in the Word that deal with some of the great specific fears. You know, really, we arrive on the scene without very many instinctive fears. Some students of human behavior say we have an instinctive fear of loud noises. I think that's probably right. My taste in music has changed, but I was trying to play ping pong over in the Nowlin Center. And I could hardly play because of this thing they had up in the corner of the room blasting out something or another. And I decided I'm still afraid of loud noises or something. Anyway, but that's one of the instinctive fears. Fear of falling is thought by some to be one of the instinctive fears, but that's about it. We learn our fears. Generally, there's a kind of epidemic that spreads fear. Now, obviously, some fears are creative and necessary. You know, it wouldn't be wise just to rush out across Wilshire Boulevard without doing a little looking around. There are some fears that have a purpose, but we learn a lot of fears. And well-meaning parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and others instill certain fears. Some of them are not altogether wholesome. And finally, the time comes when we're just kind of spinning in a mud hole of fear. Now, where is the real answer? Let's look at this story in its context. By the way, it's interesting when you compare it with the related accounts. Mark 6. Jesus commands them to leave and go across there. And the Mark account talks about they're still rowing in the fourth watch of the night. Brother, they've been at it for hours. Hours and hours through the night. And I think there'd probably been some frustration. And maybe in the early going, they took it out on those oars. They wanted to make him a king. And I imagine some of these disciples thought, hey, that's a pretty good idea. That's what I want. And I'd have a chance at prime minister. James and John are probably thinking, I might be on the right hand. My brother over there on the left, that's probably what James and John both are thinking. They said Abraham Lincoln was walking the streets of Springfield, Illinois with his two boys. And somebody said, what's wrong? The boys were bickering. Said, same thing wrong with the whole world. I've got three knots and both boys want two of them. Well, I imagine both James and John are thinking, I could be on the right hand, my brother over there on the left. And yet Jesus is not going to be that kind of king. In John 18:36, he tells Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. He verbalizes it. He just comes out and says it in so many words. Let me tell you what he does in John 6. And John 6 is an important event. Non-verbally, but very strongly, Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. He says it without words here, and in John 18, he says it with words. It's not that kind of kingdom at all. And I can imagine you've got so many people out here in a rather obscure place, away from where the great annual feast is going on, and there have even been articles in the scholarly journals about this, because now they're wanting to make him a king. And that spirit of insurrection against Rome has reached a fever pitch. Let's make him a king, let's make him a king. And he feeds the 5,000. And he demonstrates his deity by that great sign. But he's not going to be that kind of king at all. And so he withdraws himself. And in the other accounts, he tells them to leave out. And I think that puzzled them. I think they were a little bit bewildered, and I think they were somewhat frustrated. What's wrong with being a king? We're tired of this Roman yoke. I'm sure the same feelings of nationalistic pride and the same spirit of rebellion. In fact, one of the 12, as you know, was a zealot. I think all of them had some of that. And now he won't have it, and he sends us off. And here they are rowing, and they row for quite a while. Mark's account, Mark 6, makes that clear. All right, let's look again at it. And before the reading that we've already looked at, the reaction to the miracle is, this is the prophet. The reaction to the feeding of 5,000, this is the prophet that's come into the world. That may be looking back to Deuteronomy 18. A prophet shall the Lord thy God raise up. A prophet like Moses, Moses is saying. And him shall you hear in all things. And a lot of times when you hear that expression, the prophet, you have it back early in John's Gospel, they ask John the Immerser, are you the prophet? That's looking back to Deuteronomy 18. This is the prophet that's come into the world. Well, there's truth in that. He's more than just that. But there's truth in that. They want to make him a king. He'll have no part of it. He sends them away. And the parallels in the synoptics make that probably more clear than this. Look at verse 18. The sea was rising by reason of a great wind that blew. Let me tell you a little bit about the Sea of Galilee. Probably most of you know it. Kind of a bowl-shaped sea. Below sea level. Surrounded by hills. And between those hills, between the precipice of the mountains or hills about the Sea of Galilee, you would have those crevices that would serve as wind tunnels. The sea was relatively shallow. And so the wind could hit it. Terrific blast. And these men who were fishermen by trade were used to that, accustomed to how the storm could come up suddenly and be violent, extremely violent. They dealt with that, doubtless many times. Peter and Andrew, James and John, they weren't strangers to that, but they respected it. They knew what it could mean. And something like that happens, and you have a storm. All right, they had rowed 25, 30 furlongs, quite a distance. And the fourth watch thing in Mark 6 makes it apparent they'd done this for quite some time, and they were afraid. And now they see our Lord walking across that water, and they perhaps are the more afraid. They are afraid. But now listen to the statement in verse 20. He saith, "It is I, be not afraid." And the "it is I" is the familiar ego a me that is repeated over and over in John's Gospel. I am. Probably used in virtually every case with a conscious awareness of the Exodus 3 incident. Moses, in the incident of the burning bush, asked, "Whom shall I say sent me?" When they ask, "What's his name?" What am I to say? I am that I am. And now in John's Gospel, the I am thunders. I am. Ego me. Don't be afraid. I am. I'm one in nature with the Yahweh of the burning bush. I'm one in nature with the God who confronted Moses back there. I am. I can take care of the sea. I can take care of you. You don't need to fear. What's the answer to the problem? I am. I am. I am, and because of that, be not afraid. The very term suggests deity, godhood. This is God incarnate. This is God Emmanuel. This is God with us. So don't be afraid. Let me make some practical suggestions with regard to our fight with fear. And then let me come back to the thing that's so important here. Number one, describe the fear. I think in prayer that we sometimes need to say, "Lord, I fear the following. I'm afraid of this." And to ourselves, and sometimes even in petition to Him, we need to describe the fear. A lot of us are victimized by a low-grade fever of pervasive fear. Sometimes it's even hard to define. And for that reason, it's good for our own sake. Some have even suggested just do it with pencil and paper. Describe the fear. What is it really? Sometimes it will not be so fearful when we do that. And certainly when we come to the Lord, we need to speak clearly, definitively of what we're afraid of. I think sometimes we're afraid even to ourselves or to the Lord. Say, "Lord, I have a fear here." We all do. I certainly have repeatedly. We face things that we face with apprehension. Describe the fear. Don't live out life's little day paralyzed by permeating, pervading, low-grade fever of fear, sometimes not even clearly defined. Get it out there and deal with it. Describe the fear. Number two, dissect the fear. Now, biology wasn't my favorite thing, but I learned one thing about dissecting frogs. You cut them open. You find out what's inside. Dissect the fear. Sometimes it's so foolish that in itself will go a long way toward overcoming it. I'm afraid because of this, and this is what's involved. You know, I really think that there are people problems a lot of times with a lot of our fears, and I think that really relates to evangelism. I think that's why the natural evangelism is so wonderful. We fear rejection, we fear humiliation, we fear failure, and we're not comfortable making this frontal approach. But I think all of us very comfortably, very easily, in a very relaxed way and free from fear, can cultivate a friendship, can express love, and can watch for the time when the door will open and we'll say, Hey, I want to know a little more about this. I've been corresponding with a person in Alabama for quite a long time. I borrowed a book from Marilyn and Bob Forrester, an excellent book on evidences by Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And I kept saying in these letters, "I've got a book I want to send you." I'm real generous with my friend's book. I just send them around the country. I said, "I got a book I want to send you." Nothing about the book. Correspondence kept on, but nothing about the book. And then finally, send me that book. And boy, I sent it. And I think some things are beginning to change. Well, doors will open. And I think one of the wonderful things about the kind of evangelism we've been talking about recently, been hearing about, is that it does so much to dissipate our fear. And if we're honest, it's the fear factor that's held us back in personal evangelism. But when it's natural, when it's a matter of expressing love and appreciation and esteem and building some kind of rapport and relationship and allowing the Lord and His providence to open some doors, any of us can do that. Well, describe the fear, dissect the fear, disown the fear. Somewhere down the line, we have to exercise our will. I want you to get out of the 2 Timothy passage, 2 Timothy 1:7. God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of discipline. Discipline. King James translates it sound mind. Sometimes we just have to say, I disown this. In the power of my Lord, I'm through with this. I see the folly and foolishness of it. And so, since God gives not the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of discipline, I'm going to exercise some of that. And I'm going to exercise my will. And I'm going to surrender this thing to my Lord, and I'm going to disown it. Number four, displace the fear. Put something in place of it. John's the master at that. And after having lived a long time, an old man at Ephesus now, writing probably in the 90s of the first century, we hear him saying, 1 John 4:18, perfect love casteth out fear. Apply that to some of the specific fears. Here's fear of people. Love them. You're not going to be afraid of them, right? Serve them. Love them. Be their servant. Express your love to them. You're not going to be afraid of them. Most of us have gone through life kind of like Charlie Brown. He said, I love humanity. It's people I can't stand. And so we have people fears. What are they going to think about me? Well, perfect love casteth out fear. And you can apply that to a lot of other fears. Fear hath torment. Fear hath punishment. And he that feareth is not made perfect in love. And while we talk about describing, dissecting, disowning, and now deplacing that particular fear, or replacing it, we talk about deplacing the fear. Perfect love casteth out fear. I want you to look at Revelation 1. Jesus through John, and Jesus to John, and John's on Patmos, and that wasn't very much fun. That was exile. On an island, in a very unpleasant kind of situation. So John's an exile, John's a captive, and Jesus says, right here almost at the outset of Revelation, don't be afraid. I saw him. Revelation 1:17. John, who are you seeing? Well, I'm seeing the one that had in his right hand the seven stars, and out of his mouth proceeded a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun that shineth in his strength. And I was afraid. I saw him and I fell at his feet as one dead. And he laid his right hand upon me and he said, fear not. Fear not. Don't be afraid. John chapter 6, I am, ego, eimi. Don't be afraid. Revelation chapter 1, don't be afraid. Fear not. Fear not. Verse 17. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. And was dead and am alive forevermore. And I have the keys of death and Hades. I have authority over death. I have authority over the realm of the unseen. Don't be afraid. We talk about deplacing your fears. And replacing them with something else. Remember in John 6, he got into the boat. And when he's in the boat, whether that's a boat on the stormy Sea of Galilee, the tempest-tossed Lake Gennesaret, or whether he is in the boat of your heart and life, brother, that's the end of fear. What we have to do is let him in. John, don't be afraid. Revelation 1, I'm the living one. I have the keys of death and Hades. John chapter 6, don't be afraid on storm-tossed Galilee. It's I am, ego eimi. Don't be afraid. Let him into the boat. And dare daily to face your fear and overcome it. Dare daily to deal daily with fear. Emerson said, you have not rightly learned to live until you've learned to surmount a fear each day. In the strength of our Lord, let's face that foe and overcome. God has not given the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. There's a passage I love. It serves well to show something significant in the great redemptive scheme, but it's also very, very practical. Hebrews chapter 2, 14 and 15. For as much as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, He knows about this body. He knows about our humanity. He likewise partook of the same, took part of the same, that through death He might destroy him that had the power of death and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. The fear of death is overcome. The instinctive, age-old, universal fear is overcome. The evil one cannot overcome us with spiritual death. The bonds of physical death cannot hold us. He's the living one. He has the keys of death and Hades. We said this morning that peace is in a person. And let me say tonight that victory over fear is in a person, the Lord Jesus Christ. And over in the Gospels, not just John 6, not just Mark 6, not just parallels to this passage, but over and over, fear not, fear not, fear not, fear not. In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world, our Lord affirms. Close of John chapter 16. Fear not. Maybe that you're out of Him. And that means, my friend, that you're impoverished in a way I can't describe. I don't have the words. I don't have the capacity to describe how impoverished any of us are if outside of Him. I wouldn't want to enter into a venture. I wouldn't want to take a trip. I wouldn't want to live a day without Him. But He's the difference between nothing and all things. And I'm urging you tonight to come to Him. If you've been living in the grip of an unhealthy, unholy kind of fear, why don't you just commit that to Him? Why don't you just dare to leave it with Him and let Him in the boat? And remember that the great I Am can take care of all the storms in your life. The One who stilled the sea in Galilee can still the storm that comes across the heart or comes across your very life. You're here, responsive to His will. Come right now, as we stand, while we sing.